Saturday, October 29th, in Barampuram Palace, Bangkok, Thailand. Helen woke me at 6 o'clock for the adventure I had looked forward to almost most of all on this trip, a tour of the Klongs. I had coffee in the tub in the huge marble and tile bathroom, as big as any living room I've nearly ever had, and before 7 was dressed and ready to go. Mrs. Graham Martin, our ambassador's wife, came for me, and we went to the Royal Landing and boarded the Queen's own launch, 40 feet of gleaming mahogany, shiny brass, and white scalloped canopy. Kunying Molly Komen, the wife of the foreign minister, was along, and a lovely young woman whom I'd met on my trip before, called Wee Wan, who's the daughter of Prince Wan. She's in the Foreign Service and an excellent interpreter. And Mrs. Anita Murchie, the wife of our USIS officer, who's fluent in Thai. Two ladies in waiting represented the Queen, who couldn't be with us because she has a bad cold. And of course, Liz was there, anxious, interested, alert every minute to get the most colorful pictures and story for the other part of her constituency, the press. So we set forth for 2 hours that I shall never forget, most crowded, romantic, vivid page in my memory. The Klong is a slow, narrow stream lined with houses and little stores. It is the heart's artery of this exotic capital. The people live beside it, trade on it, bathe in it. It is lined with houses, two-storied, made of teak, bannistered and railed, orchids in pots on the porch, roofed with tin or tile, with schools that are bursting with children, ancient moss-covered watts, ornate domes reaching to the sky, little shops that sell hats or coffee or meat and fish. Mostly it is teeming with life, with hundreds and hundreds of Thais lining the bank, smiling, waving, saying something that sounded like chayo, chayo, with group after group after group of little children, the boys dressed in khaki shorts and white blouses, the little girls in blue skirts and white blouses, all with waving flags and big smiles. Several were so excited they fell in the Klong. The Klong itself was full of traffic. What Liz called the Thai Navy followed us. And behind them, a huge lumbering boat full of the press with their cameras, frantically trying to record these wonderful pictures, but dexterously prevented, unhappily, by the officials in between. But the real traffic were the people trading. Little wooden boats with a square lip at the front and at the back, into which the people stepped as easily as I would step into my living room or kitchen. So much at home on the Klong are they. And in the boat, their wares. Bananas or coconuts or oranges, papayas, love apples, a stack of roast ducks, orchids, orchids, orchids. Vegetables I couldn't identify. Some of them looked like squash or shallots or turnip greens. And whole boats loaded with hats for sale. Soon, a boat came along us, and a woman offered me a gift of orchids, or a basket of oranges, or a cluster of bananas. Within an hour, we could have gone into business ourselves. Wee Wan told me that most of the houses had their own little orchard behind them, or their little garden patch, where they raised the things they sold. Sights I will remember. A glimpse into a house where I saw a picture of the king and queen on the wall. Another, a small hammock swaying gently, suspended from the beams. It was the baby's cradle. And another, a sign saying, cockfights, and then fish fights. A white cockatoo swaying gently in his perch in a love apple tree. A cage of rabbits, but I was told they were not being sold for meat, but for pets. I could believe it. Everywhere there were dogs and cats. A woman cooking her family's meal on a little charcoal stove. I asked Mrs. Komen what it was, and she said, probably a mixture of tapioca and pork. Some of the boats are large, obviously lived in by a family, who probably are born, live, and die in their boat on the Klongs. We passed 2 sawmills, stacks of lumber, teak, I was told, and a coffee shop, a sort of social center. But to me, the whole Klong is a social center. And once a man who was up to his chest in the Klong, calmly lathering himself with soap, the only one, I think, who did not notice us. Once there was an old woman who came up to the boat with her gift, and her smile revealed teeth that were quite brown from chewing betel nut. Many of the groups of boys and girls that we passed had on the uniforms of girl guides or boy scouts or brownies or cub scouts. They were all singing and smiling, and several of them fell in their excitement, and they quite put an end for me with the oft-repeated phrase that the Thais are impassive and withdrawn. Several times there were tourists, and once, inevitably, someone called, "Welcome to Thailand, Mrs. Johnson. We are from Texas." Kunying Molly had brought along fruits and sweets and coffee, but I had a hard time stopping for a drink. There was so much to see and do, and there was always a boat drawing up beside ours with a gift. The least I could do in return was one moment of contact, of eyes and smile and appreciation. The past little boys wearing T-shirts that advertised Asian games, and frequently we saw an ad in Thai which we could not read except for one word, such as fab, apparently a favorite of ours. Often along the way, there were golden altars decorated with flowers right at the edge of the klong, with a cluster of people sitting cross-legged on the ground around it. This, I was told, meant that they had great respect for me. One keeps one's head below a revered person. The klong was also racing with fast little boats that had outboard motors, some with a long shaft about 4 feet and the propeller on the end. In this crowded klong, I could see what the king meant when he spoke of them as dangerous, and how he was trying to invent and get produced one that would be just as fast but not so dangerous. The fronds of palm trees swayed above the houses, and amazingly, there was a long line of poles with wires. Telephone or electricity, I did not know. And out beside each house, its big terracotta jars catch the rainwater, their supply of drinking water. Otherwise, all their needs were filled from the klong itself. And very often, standing on a little stilt, the spirit house, a sort of a miniature temple, brightly decorated, frequently garlanded with flowers, and every few blocks, the bright orange tile roofs of a wat. Once I saw a man with a little charcoal stove on which there was a steaming kettle and lots of tiny cups. He was selling coffee. Sometimes bunting was strung along the klong, and nearly everywhere there were flags in poles and signs of welcome President and Madam Johnson, and one, a poster, hailed the protection of world justice. But the real experience to me was a varied tapestry of life, a crowded, teeming life of the klong itself. I do not know that there was any 2 hours on my trip I shall cherish as much. A little past 9, we docked and made our way through one of the Thai handicraft shops, where I got a quick look at some silk being woven, was introduced to some of the handicraft people, and then into the car and back to Barampaman Palace in time to change into my blue linen and ride with Mrs. Martin to Chulalongkorn University, where Lennon was to receive an honorary doctorate in political science. The colorful ceremony took place in an auditorium of the university, witnessed by the Thai cabinet, including Prime Minister Kittikachorn, and as many of the 8,000 students and professors of the university as could crowd in. Beginning in 1938, at Little Southwestern in Georgetown, and in the 28 years since, I've participated in a lot of honorary degrees, but the Thais take the prize for having the right kind of academic robes. The top professors of the university filed in, and then His Majesty the King, escorting Lyndon, and everybody had on a robe made out of net. Sheer, cool, just right for the Thai climate. Lyndon's and the King's were banded in gold and red braid, others in pink and silver braid. It was a beautiful sight. I wish Lennon could wear this robe in any June academic ceremony where there's no air conditioning. The King is a slight, dark, intense young man, seldom smiling, who wears dark glasses because of an eye injury. You feel that he is very earnest about his country and working searchingly at his job. There's an air of constraint whenever he is present, or so it seemed to me, everybody being very deferential and dignified. I felt rather sorry for him and the Queen. I wonder how they ever get through to simple contacts, to laughter, or if people ever tell them an unpleasant truth. The King himself gave Lyndon the citation, and in Lyndon's speech, he made an appeal to the leaders of Hanoi to lay aside arms and sit down together at the table of reason, and spoke of all the things we could do, the constructive things for health and education, if we could lay aside our arms. And then a most unusual thing happened. He signed the International Education Act, which will bolster international training and research, both graduate and undergraduate, in American colleges. The first time any American legislation has ever been signed on foreign soil. There was one line in his speech that rang in my mind as the whole summation of our day. The central tragedy of our times is the human and material waste that goes into war. That tells the whole story of today. We filed into a big reception room. Champagne was passed. A gift was presented to me. And then Lyndon and I parted, he to step out into the flag-waving crowd of smiling students, not a protest banner in sight. And as he was swamped by their reaching hands and engulfed by their cheers, I thought of the warnings we'd had all along that these were a very retiring people who would not express themselves. Lyndon was enjoying it, but he was mindful of the king's presence, which always imposes the necessity of being restrained and quiet. So he made as little of it as possible, reaching for a few hands and smiling into all the eyes he could, and then was in his car and gone. And I drove with Mrs. Martin across the campus to the Red Cross building. There, Queen Sirikit met us. She's one of the most genuinely beautiful women I've ever seen. A very sweet face, gentle, composed. I cannot imagine her making a loud or ugly noise. She wore a chartreuse and blue printed blouse over a long bright blue skirt. Every time I see her, I remember that I've read she is one of the world's best dressed women. It's a flag that sort of precedes one once you've got the title. I was presented with a Medal of Merit from the Golden Bowl, in which all things are given to one. On my first trip here, I thought she was supposed to take the bowl. And I presented the hospital with a telethermometer, which records the body temperature of 6 patients simultaneously and continuously. On this trip, I have learned what ladies-in-waiting are for. They take the bouquets, the gifts, from the queen when the moment of the presentation is over, so that she will not be burdened. In Thailand, leis have become, instead, bracelets that one wears around the arm or wrist, made of thousands of tiny cream-colored blossoms, with a long tassel of red and pink or yellow and cream-colored, sewed together in a very elaborate design. I cannot look at them without calculating the hours of labor it took to produce one. They're overwhelmingly fragrant. The queen gently led me through some of the wards. The patients were sitting cross-legged on the beds and greeted us with impassive faces mostly, and the joined hands and bowed heads, the traditional greeting of their country. That is, the old ones did. The young ones and the nurses were all smiles and lively interest. It was a brief ceremony. The queen talked to me about her work with the Red Cross, the need for more hospitals, and I told her of the Senate Ladies' Red Cross unit and asked about her cold. It is better. And then we said goodbye, and with Mrs. Martin, I went to the Dusit Zoo, our last stop of the day, where I was met by the director and the deputy prime minister's wife, and spent an hour strolling around the grounds, looking at the topiary shrubs, which are most imaginatively clipped into the shape of birds and Thai dancers and dinosaurs. Very lifelike and amusing, and very lot of work. And feeding stalks of sugarcane to the elephants, while Jerry looked on with a pretty jaundiced eye. And then bananas, which is a little more difficult because they're pretty small. The elephants were as gentle as lambs. Mm-hmm. And feeding pieces of bread to the carp that bound out of the lake to grab them, some of them 2 or 3 feet long. We saw the royal white elephant that the king is supposed to ride on ceremonial occasions. But he wasn't white at all, except for his enormous toenails and his eyes. And his trunk is a sort of a mottled grayish. The director of the zoo presented me with an albino turtle to take home to the Washington Zoo. Crowds of children followed me everywhere I went, and inevitably, when I asked one of them his name, he was a Texan, Mark Cantu of San Antonio. In the lake, 3 young elephants were having a bath, roiling around and enjoying themselves, but quite obedient to their keeper and his stick. It was a pleasant park, very full of children, and this day even more full of photographers. We stopped at a refreshment stand and had half a coconut with straws in it, and I drank the sweet, bland liquid. But by now I was beginning to wilt. It had been a long time since coffee in the tub at 6 o'clock. So we signed the last of many guest books of my 6-hour sightseeing trip and went back to Barampaman Palace, where I had a quiet lunch with Lyndon, and then collapsed in bed for a while. Close to 5, I put on my yellow lace dress, my wedding dress. Lyndon and I went to Government House for the Prime Minister and Mrs. Kittikachorn's reception. With 3 days in Manila and 2 here, I'm beginning to feel very much at home with them. He's always smiling, and she's plump, comfortable, and very pleasant. It was a beautiful party in a large, spacious hall, well organized and not crowded. They led us around the room, introducing us to groups. There was the American community, businessmen representing Singer Sewing Machine and the petroleum companies, and government officials, and other ties. I saw Prince Juan, his daughter Wee Wan, and my friend Air Marshal Dawi, and Ari, his wife. And we talked about swimming in the sunset sea. There was champagne and toast and a pleasant hour. And then, close to 6, we returned to the palace. And I made a hurried trip to Sala Sahathai, the Grand Palace, where we are giving a banquet tonight in honor of the King and Queen. I talked with Barbara Keene, who's been here managing it for several days. She looked harassed. It hasn't been easy to do, to run a party 13,000 miles from your base. She's decorated the hall with swags of yellow bunting and is using round tables and menus and press cards engraved and written at the White House. It transfers much of the flavor of the East Room and the State Dining Room as can be in this exotic setting. And then back to my large suite in the palace for a shampoo and set with such a nice hairdresser. And after having known me this long, she and her assistant have finally stopped approaching me on their knees, a custom which makes me extremely uncomfortable, and which I noticed this morning with a certain flinching when the middle-aged Red Cross officials approached the Queen on their knees, their hands outstretched in front with the golden bowl and its presentation in it. Although there's certainly nothing in her gentle manner to require that sort of groveling. I wore my ivory chiffon and pearls and felt quite elegant. And Lyndon, his white dinner jacket. And close to 8, we went to Sala Sahathai, where we were on time to greet them at the front steps and to pause for photographers, looking at the great full moon above the temple tops. The Queen was in ruby red, high-necked, long-sleeved, girdled with gold and an enormous gold ornament in the front, and lovely tie chandelier-like earrings that would be as fashionable today in our country as they are traditional here. The guest list was mostly Thai government officials, though we introduced a few American businessmen. Barbara tried bravely, but we sorely missed the wonderful setting of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. We had crab meat crepes and filet of beef and strawberry soupep. The bouquets on the yellow-covered tables were daffodils and daisies and sweet peas and asters. And in this land of orchids, looked very simple. The high point of the evening, I thought, were the toasts, both of them. Lyndon borrowed from Lincoln. A rather amusing story. The first offer of assistance between our countries was made in 1861 by your great King Mongkut. That was the king's great-grandfather and the one in whose household Anna served as tutor. And the offer was made to our great president, Abraham Lincoln. King Mongkut knew we were in a civil war. He read where we had no elephants, so he wrote to President Lincoln, offering to send him some elephants. Mr. Lincoln thought seriously about the proposal, and then he wrote a letter to King Mongkut. He thanked the king, and he said he would happily accept the offer, save for the fact that the climate in our country was too cold for elephants to prosper. The whole point of the story was that the disposition of our two countries to help each other goes back well into the past, Lyndon said. Your Majesty, President Lincoln closed his letter to your great-grandfather more than 100 years ago with these words, "Wishing for your Majesty a long and happy life, and for the generous people of Siam, the highest possible prosperity, I commend both to the blessings of Almighty God." I cannot improve upon those words. It was a good piece of research and kept us all listening. And then the king answered, quietly putting down his written text and talking off the cuff in a lively way with humor and freshness. Yes, his great-grandfather had tried to lend us elephants, which we assumed we couldn't use. And now they were certainly learning to make good use of the technical assistance that America was offering to Thailand. After the toast, we went into a great conference room, 130 so of us, and took our seats. And Stan Getz and his troop, who had come over from the United States especially for the occasion, played a medley of jazz for us. It was not my cup of tea, but it is so well known that the king is a jazz buff and has upon occasion gotten up and played an instrument right along with the band. but I think it was very enterprising of Bess and Barbara to have provided Stan Getz, and all the other guests raved about him. We bid the king and queen good night at the front door about 11:30, urging them not to get up to say goodbye to us as we left the country tomorrow morning at a very early hour. And so at 12:30, I went to bed at the end of one of the foolish days in my whole life, the high point of which was, for me, the trip on the Klong, where one could feel really immersed in the life of this exotic, romantic country.